Welcome to Metacast. I'm Josh Anderson.
And I'm Bob Galen.
Today's topic is failed sprints. How they happen, why they happen, and what you can do about it. So, Bob, have you ever had a failed sprint?
Josh, as we were talking about right before the Metacast, I just don't even know what failure looks like.
Really? Wow.
I have never seen a failed... I mean... You know, barely. I think I failed when I was two or three years old.
A few times. You kind of stubbed your toe a little bit. And
not really. I mean, I never even had an accident when I was younger. Yeah, of course. I've had down. So let's be honest. That was a lie, Metacasters. Yes, I have failed. I have, you know, been the airplane that's in flames and hitting the ground. Yes. Where do we want to start? Why don't you start with one?
So, I want to talk about ways that failed sprints happen. And I think the way you started it off is one of the most common ways. People aren't honest with themselves throughout the sprint. And they're ignoring everything that's slapping them in the face, saying your sprint is in trouble. They don't talk to the burn downs. They don't raise impediments. They don't do things like that. They blindly go on through, or maybe they know where they're going, but they don't want to have that difficult discussion of, hey guys, we're in trouble, what are we going to do about it? So I think honesty is one of the primary drivers of failed sprints. Actually, lack of it is really one of the major reasons of the sprints I've seen fail that causes them to fail.
So honesty, I mean, and you, we need to piece this stuff apart. So you talked about burn downs and lack of recognition on burn downs. So you bundled a few things in there, mm-hmm. Not paying attention. Honesty almost sounds like you're misleading yourself. And there can be, so that's one part of the pattern. I mean, the other part of pattern is just not paying attention. It would be like the lady that's running down the highway, putting her makeup on.
Right.
Right. She's honest with herself. She's just not paying attention to the road, right?
Right.
And might hit a tree. I think there's some nuance to the pattern that you bring up. Let's talk about honesty. I think there are folks, so one pattern or sub-pattern for this is a lack of honesty, a lack of fear. Could drive that.
Right.
Teams who are afraid to, you know, my management can't handle the truth. And they never want to engage with us. So yes, you're supposed to raise impediments, but no one wants to hear the impediment, right? The process says raise an impediment.
Right.
But no one really wants
to. It just goes into a black hole.
Exactly. And they ignore it. I've actually got heat about that from our team sometimes. I put on my magical, so here I am sharing my weaknesses to the Metacasters, but I put on my magical manager armor, and I sometimes want to push back. I want to deflect things to the team. So I my heart is in the right place. I want to sort of empower them, but there's some cases where there's impediments that actually that should stick to me.
Right.
And I deflect too much.
Right.
Now that's, I'm not handling the impediment. But the other insidious thing that I think that sets is it makes the impression to the team that I don't care,
right.
That I'm not listening, and I have to be very sensitive to that. And it's a balancing act for me, but I know that I've balanced the wrong way on that.
Well, that's one of the hardest things, I think, to manage as a leader in an agile group of enabling failure without causing catastrophe.
Right.
You know, of allowing the team to stumble a little bit, pick themselves up, dust themselves off, get that lesson learned, and really improve, but at the same time, not going to the other extreme and babying them to where they're always running and saying, help us, Bob. What are we going to do? You know, so...
Well, it's that ownership thing.
Yeah.
So that's what's driving me to do that. But I reflect a lot. I mean, I think one of the things that you and I probably both do is we continually self-reflect.
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing well and what are we not doing well? And I try to make micro adjustments a lot in my style, situational adjustments. And that's one of them where I've started to remind myself that I want to maybe overreact in taking things to, and the message there is not, I don't want the team to grow, but I want them to feel like I'm supporting them, right?
Right.
I'm listening to them.
Right, but I've seen folks that are trying to do that same support thing that end up causing a long-term failure by impeding their team's growth by trying to save the day right then.
Absolutely.
And then trying to do it every day.
Absolutely. And it's that situational nature. So I think there's that. The managers are setting the tone. I think there's clearly a fear pattern, where or a don't care pattern,
yeah.
where people don't give a rat about what's going on in the team. It's just suck it up, team. It's that traditional view of just, you signed up for it, now I'll deliver.
Right.
And I'm divorced from collaborating with you as your leader. So you see that as well. And I think teams, it's almost like little mini sprint death marches, So there is that quintessential death march that Jordan talked about. I think you can have that in Agile, but it's like, what? It's faster.
Yeah.
It's like death. It's death sprints, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And teams, and I'm laughing about it on the met, this morning, but it's really a serious problem where, teams. I mean, I'd rather they do waterfall. It's a little bit more humane to do waterfall for death marches than it is to like sprint yourself to death every 2 weeks or something, where no one's helping you at all.
I might disagree with that.
I would welcome a disagreement.
I'm a proponent of smaller little crashes rather than this big like crash up derby at the end, because I'm assuming, and maybe incorrectly, that if you have a death march in every 2 weeks, but you just go back to waterfall, you're going to have a death march over a 9-month project, and that death march is much more painful. And I would hope, maybe incorrectly, that somebody might get sick of those little death marches and do something about it. So I think you have the opportunity to potentially correct the ship.
I think more likely. What I was alluding to is I think traditional waterfall death marches are less painful. They're less intense.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Then the intensity of like a sprint, a 2-week sprint death march, and if you're ignoring the results, then you do it again and again and again. So that's the intensity level. So I think of sprints as being these very intense engagements.
Yes.
And if you're in a totally dysfunctional organization, now I'm intensely dysfunctional for 2 weeks, and then I'm intensely dysfunctional for another 2 weeks. It's not a debate. I mean, it's the point is the dysfunction, right?
Yeah.
So that's the leadership dysfunction. Let's switch gears within this micro pattern of, I've seen teams that don't pay attention to your point of they're not watching the road.
Right.
They have burnout charts. I've seen this in my own teams, mm-hmm. where I'm reminding the Scrum Masters, and I should never have to do this. Scrum Masters, if you're listening, I love you, all of my Scrum Masters. But why should I remind them to remind their teams like to pay attention to the burn down?
Right.
And it's such a basic thing. It's like using a football. It's like blocking and tackling.
Look at that.
Oh, yeah.
It is. I mean, but it's amazing how many teams quickly turn their back on the basic info that's being provided. I've been unable to identify why teams are so quick to begin ignoring that.
It's just, I don't know. It's complacency or something, right?
Yeah.
I think it's just, you get cocky. It's you think you know, you think you don't. I'm sure this happens in sports. That's what I was bringing up.
Yeah.
The football analogy, basketball. I think a lot of times you talk about coaches who turn programs around, and you read about this incessantly, and what do they do? One of the first things they do is go back and emphasize the basics. And these people, basketball players, they've been playing basketball for 10 years or 15 years. So it's not that they don't know, it's that they've forgotten the basics.
Right.
And you go back, and then you turn the program around. Now, that's not the only recipe for it.
Right.
But
that's very common.
But it's a very you see that as a very common pattern. And I think that happens a lot in Agile teams. When I was a more active Scrum Master, and maybe this is my nature, my personality type, I'm sort of pit bullying, and I try to focus on things. But I would never get off point on like burndowns.
Right.
So every day I used to have the daily stand-up, I looked at the first minute and a half as being my stage as the Scrum Master,
mm-hmm.
if you will. And I wasn't trying to be selfish, and I wasn't trying to be a command and control Scrum Master, but I would every day I would look at things. Like one day we would look at how are we doing to the sprint goal?
Mm-hmm.
And I would ask the team that question.
Right.
The next day I would talk about, burn down. How are we burning down? Are we paying attention? Look at if we had sub burn downs, like, development tasks versus testing tasks, whatever.
Right.
Is there any nuance there? And I would challenge the team. I would also even sometimes jump up on a soapbox for 30 seconds and explain the why. So I would look at it as a training, a mini training opportunity. But it was always trying to bring us back to basics or trying to add a little nuance. And I got great service. The results of the team were great by doing that, right? That we stayed on point, right? And it was just my nature to do that.
Did your minute and a half trail off over time?
No, you know what and that's an interesting question. I didn't think about it. I kept doing it.
Yeah,
it was weird. It was that. I guess it was that staying sharp, staying on point, and maybe that's sort of the answer here behind it. Is if you're not consistently focusing just a bit. I mean, a minute, literally, it was a minute and a half or 2 minutes.
Right, yeah.
I would cut myself off. But that reminder of what was most important at the moment, I kept doing that. And it wasn't because there was a need for it.
Right.
If that made sense. Like, for example, I would jump up on the soapbox and I would talk about WIP. Mm-hmm. You know, one time I would talk about work in progress.
Right.
And how we were having too many stories. So it was very situational.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always basics. It was always, you know, how many stories do we have in point? I would talk about doneness criteria. We're slipping on our doneness criteria. We're not, you know, we slipped up in a micro way, not in a macro way.
Right.
So I think we miss basics. What else with that pattern? Is it? I don't know if it's cockiness so much.
I think that plays a part, right?
Of,
hey, I've been doing software for X number of years.
Oh,
I can
know
do
what?
This.
I
know what I'm
agile
doing.
Cockiness, but you know what? You're right.
Yeah.
I think part of the pattern is software development cockiness.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what? Now that you mentioned, I think that probably is a part of that pattern. I've been doing this for.
Yeah. I know what I'm doing. I can write good code.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. You know,
so did we beat this one? I think not beat it. I think there was a good discussion around. So there's the paying attention anti-pattern for for Scrum for sprint failure.
Right.
What else is there? I hope we didn't steal all of our thunder.
No. So there's the outside influence of change in priorities, of not having your sprint goals locked down for 2 weeks. Somebody comes in and just blows up everything that you're doing. So you have a bad chicken. You have a rogue chicken that comes in and tries to change everything, that throws you off kilter. I know one of the things that we were big on while you were working with me was drag and tracking all that drag that happened that was really slowing us down and things like that. So there can be external forces that will cause your sprint to head towards failure. I think if you have a good scrum master, you can potentially beat that back and protect the team and say, hey, listen, we have 4 days left in our sprint.
Right.
Let's let this team finish what they're doing, and then we'll get that prioritized with our work. So I think that's one easy way to try and combat that is to just say, hey, give us 3 more days or 4 more days or whatever, and we'll get to that. We understand the priority, but let us finish what we've started. Now, that can sometimes be a tough sell, and there's times where that's just not the appropriate thing to do. But I've seen some sprints fail because of that, because it's not managed well by the scrum master or the product owner or the team at all. The team doesn't even raise the question of, hey, this is putting us at jeopardy.
Well, it's situational, right? It's situational. It depends on, I mean, to me, the timing. So I have this notion of replanning a sprint. Sometimes So the scrum book gives you this, what do? You can cancel a sprint and then restart a sprint. So your only recourse, I think, by the book, as I recall, is you can continue to the end of a time box and deliver on what you did, or if an interrupt comes in, you can, cancel the sprint, and then redo sprint planning and then execute.
Right.
So if you have synchronized sprint teams, scrum teams, then it would be a reduced sprint or something like that. And then, so that's the hard replan from my perspective. And then I've done a soft replan, which is, okay, something happened, externally happened, and we need to make an adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
So then let's look at our sprint plan and then to make some adjustments to it and recommit. So change the goal, change the task slightly. And I don't mean to reuse whatever plan you have.
Right.
So it doesn't have to take forever at all. But make some adjustments so you can have a congruent recommitment to it.
Mm-hmm.
But even that, like if it's day 7 of a 10-day sprint, I've actually recommend, let's just continue.
Yeah.
Right. you can get 3 days of work and you can replan and stuff. To your point, sometimes it's just execute, even though you're quote unquote failing, you're still getting stuff done.
Right.
I don't think it's really the case where you're doing something that is absolutely waste.
Right, I think that's another really strong case for shorter sprints for newer teams.
Yeah.
To enable that defense mechanism of let's just let this team finish. Because I know there's so many teams that want to start off with large sprints. Let's do a month, or I've even heard 3 months and things like that, where your ability to deflect things like that becomes very limited.
Well, you'd be replanning like five times during it or something
Exactly.
that. Or you're right. I mean, shorter sprints give you a lot of flexibility. So external interrupts, one way, you know, one recommendation is to continue and get lessons learned. Mm-hmm. So almost train the organization. I think a side effect is getting the organization to not just look at work, but look at it as sort of a machine or a mechanism that I'm iterating and I'm producing value in the team. So in that case, even if the work is waste, the team has learned. So you have lessons learned, right? Mm-hmm. And have everyone, not just the team, value that, but management or leadership value. You know, okay, we've learned something. Now what are we going to do the next time?
Right.
Differently. But you look at that as value, and I think by default they don't historically look at that as value.
Right.
What about internal interrupts? What about, so you had the external interrupts. Have you ever had a team, you know, the team blew estimates?
Yeah, that was the next one.
And it's like, holy crap, you know, we thought we could get this story done. So there's the external interrupt side. I think there's two types of internal interrupts I've seen. One is the, the Chicken Little on the team, like the sky, you know, on day two, the sky is falling.
Yeah.
Right? So forget, that could be estimates, that could be anything. That could be the, you know, the sunlight in my chair is at the wrong temperature and the sky is falling. And the team rallies around Chicken Little to estimation issues, and you have to make adjustments.
Right, that's one thing that I've had a couple talks with a few of my teams of telling them that they've actually failed a sprint, even though they've delivered what they committed. You know, they said, hey, we got everything done. Like, so how many hours on the weekend did you work to get that done?
Oh, there's a good,
You know, and yeah, they met their goals, but that's a failure. You know, you have to be honest with yourselves and say, you know what, yeah, we had to work the weekend to get it done, but you can't continue to do that because your team's going to crash and burn and they're just going to burn out. And
Josh, they worked the weekend, for God's sakes. Come on, that's great. That's two extra days a week.
Yeah, it's very sustainable, too.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, come on.
Yeah, so
we want to suck up as much of that as we possibly can. Yes. That's free. That's free time.
Yeah.
Right. What are you whining about? That's not a failure. That's a win.
Well, but see, that's how it was viewed, right? Yeah. Of, hey, you know, we are getting everything, but you're not. So, and it really, with the team that was with, the estimation was really a problem. And they actually volunteered to start tracking actuals, which I'm not normally a fan of, but they were tracking everything, trying to identify what was putting them in such bad situations in each and every sprint. And the estimation is really what it came down to. And so that ended up circling back all the way back to the grooming of they weren't doing a good enough grooming process. Yeah. So they were kind of winging it within sprint planning and winging it pretty badly.
But that's a dangerous, you know what I'm going to say? That's a dangerous trend, right? With the actuals.
Yes. Right? So. I'm not a fan of actuals, but the team volunteered of, hey, let's do it. Let's figure out what's putting us in weekend work every 2 weeks.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a positive effect. I mean, I think for the Metacasters, it's like you want to be careful about how you handle, I think, tracking actuals. So if it's a learning, if it's team-induced, I've seen that in the past as well, and I've sort of allowed it, meaning I didn't, you know, it's like, okay, team, you know, you stink at estimation. If you track actuals, I mean, I've actually had folks put their actuals on their cards when we're doing it on walls and things like that. And we tracked it, but what they were doing is they weren't reporting on it. They were trying to get better. They were trying to figure out what was messed up in their estimation.
Yeah.
And then as quickly as we could, we turned it off.
Right.
Because I don't want... That's actually a danger sign to me. I mean, in traditional environments, anyone who sees actuals, the project managers in the room, their eyes light up. It's like, oh, this is great data.
Yeah.
And I just think it's good data for the team if you're mature enough to handle it.
Yeah.
And if they want to get better.
Yeah, but I think the real lesson learned there was that the planning was the problem. That it wasn't necessarily their estimates. It was not doing all the necessary prep work.
Yeah.
So kind of getting back to that cockiness of, hey, we know what we're doing. Yep. We can plan this sprint without doing the work that we need to do. So they didn't do the heavy lifting of really having that grooming, having those difficult discussions, fully understanding the stories. things like that. So that's one thing that if you shortchange, it's going to come back and bite you.
Now, the other danger there is, and I know I'm harping on estimates, but it's traditionally we tried to get what? We tried to, so it wasn't about the work getting better. It was about having great plans.
Right.
I mean, I grew up with this crap.
Right.
And it was a terrible view, but, you know, so you try to refine your estimates. So we spent so much time trying to get better at estimation when we should have spent more time getting better at software delivery.
Right.
So that's the danger of, like, you start padding. So look, focusing on actuals, it can also have this side effect where now I'm focusing not on the software.
Right.
The danger is that you can focus on the estimates. And then, well, I can make the estimate better by what? By padding the estimate, right? Right? And then I just narrow into the... Then I can hit it exactly.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
And you have to be careful about that to avoid that thinking. So, but I do think teams need to get better. Like estimation, probably the anti-pattern is poor estimation. And we undersell it. Well, we're either experienced or agile doesn't require it.
Right.
And I think it does help for load balancing, like when you're planning a sprint to do that. What about Chicken Little? Did we talk about Chicken Little? Have you ever seen Chicken Littles that just sort of lose it? I've seen a lot of individuals where they sort of went along for the ride in sprint planning.
Yeah.
And then this is the best way I can describe it. So because sprint planning is a team function. And I even like the behavior at the end of the sprint planning where everyone, like, goes thumbs up or thumbs down. So they commit, but then they get into the sprint and then they feel like, oh, see, it's just like, you know, you strong-armed me.
Right. And it's usually that person that, in the sprint planning, is sitting on their laptop working and not really paying attention.
You're absolutely right. They're disengaged, right? Yes. They're not fully engaged.
Yes. They are off doing something else, and they're, like, nodding along.
And then it's holy cow, right? Yeah. It's like, holy cow.
Yeah. And then, like, halfway through the sprint, you know, just like you said, the world is ending, the sky is falling, and what are we going to do?
Yep.
And it's like, well, where were you 3 days ago?
Exactly. And what about that commitment thing that you, I mean, you weren't sleeping.
Yeah.
Right. And you actually try, as I think we both as Scrum Masters, you try to be so inclusive, right? It's like, please get your, we want to be realists. So we want to get your, you know, your thoughts, your, you know, your ideas, your work estimates, everything into play. So it's an inclusive sort of process. And for folks to stand on the sidelines like that just bugs the crap out of me, right?
Right.
What would you do with them? I mean, do you do anything? Do you call them out? How do you fix that?
Well, I think to me, the first thing that you have to do is the direction that you were going is really almost force the inclusion and call them out during a sprint planning of everybody's sizing, having a discussion about a story, but... You know, Sammy's over there on his laptop doing his thing and say, okay, Sam, this is what we said. This is what we're doing. Does it make sense? Are you on board? What's the deal?
Yeah.
I need you to get involved.
Yeah.
So I think you have to do a mini call out, not directly to that specific issue, but in planning you have to.
As a Scrum Master, you can do that. I mean, that's part of the Scrum Master's job is to sort of, I don't even know if that's a call out, but that's an inclusiveness reminder.
It's an indirect call out, you know. But I think the next step is you got to have a sit-down discussion with them.
Retrospective is another, right? Get them in, nail them in the retrospect. But call them out. I'm a proponent of, like, sort of not hostile, but frank retrospectives with the team. And I think that behavior should be called, as a Scrum Master, I would at least raise it to say, did we have a concern with that? I wouldn't be trying to throw someone under the bus, but it's like, how do you improve if you don't change that behavior? So I would at least mention that in the retrospective and try to get, like, team commentary about it, like whether it was a problem or not. I think very often the team is gonna, so it's a question for you, I think the teams realize that. I don't think it's a hidden thing.
Yeah.
Right? I think you'd be doing the team a disservice if you don't bring it up rather than bring it up if they're aware of it.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the first hope is that the team does a little self correction and kind of nudges that person along and says, hey, come on, you gotta help out here. You can't keep dragging us down. So that's certainly the first hope. That doesn't always happen. That's when you need a Scrum Master to step in and throw out that challenge and get them on board.
But I'm trying to think of other...
So sticking with the chicken theme, so not Chicken Little, but chicken... chickens that come in and infect a sprint. So they come into stand-ups, they take over stand-ups, They come into planning. They take over planning. So chicken takeover, where a functional manager of some sort comes in and either directly sets plans or influences folks within the team to make concessions or things like that. So I think the things that you need there to prevent that are a strong product owner to say, hey, this is not on our backlog, and a strong Scrum Master to say, how is this helping us meet our sprint goal? And things like that. So I've seen a fair share of that where you have command and control managers that aren't willing to back off a little bit.
I think it's even more. So I'm experiencing one of my functional managers is doing a presentation at the Agile conference. He got accepted.
Nice.
And he it's about the role of functional management in Agile. Is sort of his presentation. He did a local view at the Agile RTP group, and I've reviewed the slides for him, and I think it's a good talk. And he talks about, you know, when to engage as a functional manager and when not to. And I think it's more subtle. I agree with what you're saying. I'm not disagreeing with you, but I think it's a more subtle problem because I think functional managers do play a part, sort of this active chicken.
Mm-hmm.
Of coaching. I know you are an active chicken.
Yeah.
And sort of, what's really hard is knowing when to go in, like knowing when to push in and when not to.
Right.
And it's so situational. And I actually see Brian, the guy who wrote the talk, making mistakes.
Right.
And I know I make mistakes with this, right?
Yeah.
You know, so here's an expert. He's not an expert, but he's just sharing his lessons learned. But I think we all struggle with that, of when to push and when to pull in. And I think it requires strong product owners and strong Scrum Masters, but also self-aware Scrum Masters who can take it when I push back.
Right.
You know what? I hope I'm making sense. Where they're, it's not just a block. They can't just block you.
Yeah.
And it's something, they're listening. And they're like, oh, okay, maybe I'll give Bob a shot this time and see what happens. Because maybe he has a clue and maybe he has a different perspective. I was doing this. I had a real passionate debate with one of my Scrum Masters yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about how to plan, you know, whether to do single team work or multiple team. And how do we do in our release planning? How do we...
Right.
It's easier to have one team take the work from A to B, but sometimes from a functional perspective, that's not always the easiest. So no one else is learning. No other team is learning.
Right.
It's a risky play, right? It can be risky if the work is end-to-end and it hits a release boundary. Well, now you have no fallback.
Right.
Right? Unless if something came up. So from risk and mitigation. So we were having this debate. So I think there's that tenseness is going to always sort of happen in teams.
Yeah, so I think there's a balance. It's like anything. It's not black or white. I've seen some times where it gets to black and white, and it can be pretty painful. And to me, a very common symptom of that is the chicken pop-up, right? So you don't see the chicken for a couple days. They don't come to the stand-up, and then they show up and want to change everything. You know, so that's a very common symptom. So if you're in a sprint and you have chickens that randomly pop up, it's like that whack-a-mole game.
Yep.
You know, they show up and like, hey, I'm here, I want to change everything.
Yep.
You know, that's a common symptom. I think if your functional managers are there consistently helping out, being a guiding force as opposed to a destructive redirection force, I think then you're in good shape. So if you have the whack-a-mole manager that pops up,
there's that extreme whack-a-mole.
Get worried.
But even, like I was saying, even with, I get feedback from the teams that the managers are, so there's little mini whack-a-moles that we need to do, right? We're people, and we're reacting in the wrong way, and sometimes we're right, and sometimes we're wrong, and we're trying to be situational. So there's cases where Brian is too heavy-handed.
Right.
And there's cases where you need to trust the team and allow the team to fail, or allow the team to succeed, or let the team alone.
Right.
I struggle with that. I mean, I'll be honest. I struggle with that myself as a coach.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know if you do, but
I mean, that's the hardest part, is finding that magical balance of when to guide, when to back off.
Yeah. I struggle with it immensely. And for me, it's every damn team.
Yeah.
It's different for every darn team. You don't always know. I probably have a tendency to over-engage.
Mm-hmm.
And that should come as a shock to you.
Yeah. See, now, I'm on the other side of the spectrum where I tend to under engage and I get that feedback of, hey, we could use a little bit more, because I'm always so concerned about command and control and taking that over and not enabling them. I'm almost on the under engagement to try and over enable, which sometimes causes problems.
Yep.
You know, so that is that delicate balance.
I've seen that. No, I think you and I have that. Those different styles. I saw that with you, that you were. Again, you're not an inactive coach, but you have that lineage, and I think I have the lineage sometimes of I want to correct,
mm-hmm.
right? I want to share a lesson. Now, it's not that I don't demand a change, but I demand of, hey, let's consider this. This is what I'm observing. Could you please consider this right now and make an adjustment? So I'm much more sort of fine-tuning the throttle. But in that case, again, it can come off as overly pushy.
Right.
And it can come off as Bob is telling us to do something.
Right.
Right. So then we're following Bob rather than we're following ourselves.
Right.
And I sense that at eye contact, I have a tendency. And I think for me, it's a dual role. I think for dual role, I have I'm a director of R&D and I'm also an agile coach.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it's the interpretation of me. I think folks look at me much more as the director of R&D than they do as an agile coach. And it's the what? It's the influence that that has. Right. The role has the role
yeah.
influence.
Yeah. So I try to preface some of my comments with, this is Agile Josh or Manager Josh.
Right.
You know. Ignore me as a manager. Think of me only as Agile Coach now, or vice versa. You know, things like that to try and combat some of that.
Absolutely. Why don't we talk about failure about delivery? I'm thinking. And what I mean by that is, let's talk around, we committed to 10, I'm going to just use user stories. So we committed to 10 user stories, we deliver 7, is that a failure, Josh? We deliver 13, is that a success, Josh, or a failure? We deliver stuff, we hand stuff off.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any failure points there that you've seen?
If I think I know where you're going, I'm going somewhere potentially different of, you can deliver, but is it quality?
So one aspect of that is, I delivered, but it's crappy.
Right. Yeah, we got it done.
I got 10, here's 10 lumps of something, yeah. right? And I'm proud of my 10 lumps of stuff. So there's the quality. So we didn't adhere to, so there's delivery with doneness.
Yeah.
Right? Or delivery without, you know, so I've seen crash and burns where, you know, and again, I think this goes back to traditional projects. I gave you your 10 things.
Right.
Right. Here they are. You didn't say they had to work. you didn't say they had to function. So have you seen any of that?
Yeah.
From a failure point of view?
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly, you get those sprints where things are done, but they don't meet our doneness criteria or done or whatever you want to call it. But certainly there's the other bit of, you know, we did our best. We got these 7 things done. And I think the team in the retrospective has to look at what happened and try and understand it. And that's where some of my teams have gotten into tracking actuals to try and figure out estimation issues and things like that, trying to find the root cause. That can be sometimes an all-encompassing effort where the team gets so focused on trying to root cause every little failure that they end up spending more time on that than trying to actually deliver software.
Yeah.
So that's, again, another thing to try and balance. But
I think what I'm poking at is, what is success and what is failure? So I want a reaction from you. I've actually had a team that committed to 10 stories, and they delivered 13, so they over-delivered, and they were reasonable quality,
right?
And we failed them.
Right.
And the situation there was, they had more capacity, so they sandbagged, I'm just using those terms,
right.
They sandbagged the work, they were idle on Thursday and Friday of a 2 week sprint. So they got done early and they didn't stretch to anything else.
Right.
And so they on paper they did what? They delivered.
Right.
Right. The features, they actually met their doneness criteria. There's cases where they wouldn't have, but in this case, let's say they met their doneness criteria, they over delivered on paper.
Right.
But they left capacity on the table.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, certainly that's...
Is that a failure?
Yeah, that's a failure of the team, the product owner, and the scrum master. Everybody involved right there because they let that happen. They didn't recognize that. They didn't pay attention to the burndown and see that the burndown was at zero on Thursday.
But what would be the magic number in that case then?
I don't think there is a magic number.
But what would you do with them? So let's say on Wednesday they... So what would success be? In that? How would you coach them towards success?
What's next on the backlog?
Okay.
You know, it's not, hey, we're done, let's wipe our hands and take a break. It's, okay, we got that done. Nice job. Let's find out what's next on our backlog.
So sustainable pace, filling up, working hard.
Yeah.
Right, et cetera. So that's sort of flip it around. What about a team that committed to 10 but delivered 7 and just busted their butt? Right. So and had really good behaviors. And it just turns out, back to estimation, that they misestimated the work. But they delivered on all cylinders. Let's actually say, the behavior, they knew where they were every day.
Right.
They were paying attention to stuff. But they missed their commit. They committed to 10 and they delivered 7. Would you fail them?
So I talk out of both sides of my mouth on that situation. I preach to them that, hey, when you commit, it's like when I tell my kids at 2 o'clock in the afternoon that we're going to have ice cream tonight. You know, and if they don't get ice cream and it's 8:30 and I say, hey, it's bedtime, they're going to remind me, you said I could get ice cream, Dad. What are you doing?
Exactly.
You know, so I really push that. But there are times when bad things happen to good teams. And I think you have to take, again, an honest look at what happened. And you know whether that team's really busting their butt to make it happen. The product owner, the scrum master now.
Right.
You know, and if the product owner is really engaged, they aren't going to fail that sprint. They're going to say, hey, guys, bad things happen. We got a little catch-up work to do. Let's work on it from here on out. And in a retrospective, they're going to get things out. So a team that does that is going to have all of the good behaviors that I'm not going to get too wound up about it. Now, when that happens with a team that's up and down and all over the place, that's where I'm going to get a little bit worried. But if I've got a team that's rocking and rolling and I can count on and something bad happens, I don't get too wound up about that.
I think you hit the nail for me was you used the magic word, the behaviors. So I know there's sprinkles and I know there's stories and tasks. So one, I try to measure teams against the sprint goal, not so much the story count and the task count or anything like that. So it's like what you commit to goals. You don't commit to some artificial number of days or something like that because you don't know. But the goal is important. You commit to the goal.
Right.
So how did you play your hand to the goal?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And did you keep the goal in mind every day? And then it's the behaviors of the team, right? As someone where you, did the product owner know immediately? So what would early indication, early warnings?
Right.
Did you make adjustments? So did you jettison a story because it was, did the product owner reorganize the mass of work on Tuesday, a day later, very early, and start reorchestrating things so you could get a closer step to the goal, to meeting the goal. Did the team not so much work overtime? I'm not looking for overtime, but did they work hard?
Right.
Were they intense? Were they working in priority order? Did they keep their spirit up?
Mm-hmm.
Did they work well together? And I don't think I've ever failed a team in that situation or influenced a failure.
Right.
To me, that's sort of a win. It's a behavioral win.
Yeah.
And I'll talk about it in those terms. I actually try to broadcast it because it's a learning event, I think, for other teams to use them, believe it or not, as a role model, right? Here's a team, don't look at them as by rote delivery. Look at them as like, how did they play the hand that they were dealt, right? And there's teams that can play that very poorly.
Yeah.
As well, and to me, then there's failures around that, and I try not to shy away from it. Some teams, actually, on related to this, I was at a conference, I forget, and there was a guy from I met a scrum master from Atlanta. I think he worked at broadcasting down there, Turner Broadcasting.
Okay,
and he worked at Turner, and I was talking about failures and success, sprint failure versus we declare sprints to fail or succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, you do? And he's like, we don't do that. And I wasn't trying to create controversy in the discussion at all. Right. We were just talking. And he's like, well, we call them challenge. He says, we can't use the F word down here. He's like, we can't. So he's like, well, I said, well, have you ever failed a sprint? He said, of course we failed sprints, but we don't say failure. And I'm like, well, we call them challenge. They're challenge sprints.
Right.
Because we can't acknowledge that. Well, I'm like, what do you do with a challenge sprint? Well, we don't do much different than with a challenge sprint versus a successful sprint. Well, I'm like, do you corrective action? Well, sometimes, but it really wasn't a failure. So I wonder, do you call it a failure?
I push failure within my team. I have shown them. There's a clip from Mythbusters where failure is always an option. And they talk about how teams learn from failing and how they learn from failing and how science is built on failing. So that's one of the things when I'm coaching and growing teams that I enable them to fail. And I want them to try new things that might fail.
Right.
So I don't want them to be afraid of it, and I want them to see that it's happening and try and correct it.
But what if they are afraid of it, Josh? What if they really don't? I mean, that it goes back to a Turner. I think culturally, they're really struggling. I mean, I'm not defending him.
Right.
But the F word there has terrible connotations. So how do you combat that? So I'm sort of in your school.
Right.
I call a spade a spade.
Right.
We either succeed or fail. Failure is just a word.
Right.
And I use the term fail forward all the time.
Yeah.
We want to fail forward. But I sometimes look at the teams and their interpretation of failure is different. And there's a maturity factor and there's a cultural factor
right.
to that.
Yeah, so I think it's trying to coach some of those things of the maturity factor and trying to get teams to realize that failure can be positive based on your reaction. Adversity happens to everybody. Adversity never killed anybody. It's how you react to it that really defines the direction that you personally go or your team goes. So those are the lessons that I try and coach the team on consistently. They probably get sick and tired of me saying those things, but those are the things that I really believe are truly important to team growth and personal growth. So I push those personally. I push them up the chain. I do all that.
So what would you do if you were in an organization that sort of was dysfunctional? I'm not saying how dysfunctional with failure. They didn't really understand it the way you do.
I would celebrate it.
And so what would you do? Would you change the word, or what would you do?
I would probably fight to keep the word and celebrate it a lot like you mentioned with the team that committed to 10 but got 7 done and got them done really well. I would celebrate that a lot like you're saying that you do. But if I have to give up a word, I'm not worried about that.
Okay.
You know, to me it's the message. I would probably... Initially, my first reaction would be, let's call it like it is, right? It's a failure, and let's accept that, and let's learn and grow from it.
So I think I would hang on the word. I think the word is important. Now, would I die on the word? No.
Yeah.
But I think I'm aligning with you. I think I would fight the battle on the word. I would say, let's call it what it is.
Yeah, let's be honest
with ourselves. And I would talk to upper management. I'm like, you're overreacting, right? We're in an iterative model. Gosh darn it, right? We're not failing once a year.
Right.
We're failing every 2 weeks.
Yeah, fail small.
We're failing small.
Yeah.
So get used to it. I have this conversation with her. Get used to it.
Yeah.
You know? It's not a one shot. It's sort of, we're going to succeed and we're going to have a bumpy road.
Right.
We just changed our release tempo from, I don't know if I told you this, but we went from, four 2 week sprints.
Right.
With a hardening sprint to now we're on a monthly. Did I tell you this?
Ooh.
We're on a monthly. We're on the monthly train, baby.
Nice.
We have a one sprint. So our tempo is a 1 3-week sprint. So we adjusted our 2 week cycle as well. Mm-hmm. So we're doing 3 week sprints with 1 week hardening. We'll probably reduce that, but we're on this like monthly tempo.
Nice.
And there's no planning interval between them, so we're jumping.
That's
so
good.
So 4 weeks, then 4 weeks. We call them like so. There's monthly sprints. We're deploying every once a month to production.
Right.
But then from a product perspective, we're still on like a quarterly. We're going to package things on a quarterly basis. We're calling them the seasonal. Like stealing from Sam Adams, we're calling them the seasonal releases. So
right.
we have the summer, you know, the summer ale is coming out. So we'll package 3 of those things together, and we'll turn features on and off
right.
and
Perfect.
Stuff.
Cool.
But I've been talking to our executive team about, you know, guys and gals, this is a way different tempo, and we're going to, I mean, the first sprint, for gosh sakes, is going to be really odd from the point of view of planning and right. delivery, and even how we push to production. It used to be that we would work on a Saturday, and now we don't want to work, you know,
right.
Saturday mornings every month. It's not very attractive. So right. we're going to learn a lot, and we're going to fail.
Right.
And I'm sort of preempting that. Not fail, but little f.
Right.
Not big f fail, but little f failure. We're gonna have heartburn.
Right.
What other sprint failures are there out there, do you think? So we've talked about
honesty, transparency, fear.
How about letting the team? So being two, letting the team go. I've seen, you know, the inactive scrum master.
Right.
The inactivity or a lack of engagement.
Yeah.
The product owner, we didn't talk about that. But
ooh, product owner spread too thin. You can't get the answers. You know, the team's
you got excited just then.
Yeah,
you perked up.
Yeah,
what was it?
Because that was one of the things we had really bad when we started. We had like four teams and two product owners, and that was just painful. The teams couldn't get the answers that they needed. We went upstream, said we need more product owners. We got it, and instantly the teams were off and running. That made a huge difference of just the availability of the product owners.
So the number of them, the team. If they're doing their job, and I don't mean this, I mean this respectfully, but I think one of the things our product owners are struggling with now is their responsibility in writing stories.
Yeah.
And at what level do I write stories? And I'll be clear, I think they write stories, but then they give them to the team too early.
Okay.
And it's almost like, oh, so here I threw an epic together, now dump it to the, give it to the team, and now the team's job is to refine that, but the team is really looking for more, a right. little bit more meat and potatoes from the product owner, and they're not getting it. So we have full time, we have enough of them, but it's, so I think a twist on that is, do they really understand their role?
Right.
And I want to encourage them that they should be spending, you know, I think part of the role is like, what, writing. You know, it's not just demoing. It's not just talking to executives about where the product is going. That's a real important part of it, I guess.
Right.
But it's what there's a non-sexy part of the product owner role, which is what, write stuff down.
Right.
You know, writing stories. It's not that sexy. It's really important to the team.
Yeah.
I agree. So disconnected product owners, disconnected scrum master. Not so much disconnected, but quiet. I've seen scrum masters who are just...
Yeah. You have to be willing to throw yourself out there and say, hey, guys.
Don't you? Yeah, I think that's... I think it's an important trait. And make an ass of yourself sometimes, right? You know what? No, but it's not... Be thick-skinned.
Right, yeah.
And just embarrass yourself. Be willing to be wrong just to get the team looking in a different direction.
Yep.
And throw yourself out there. So I don't think it's for the... I don't think it's for the faint of heart.
Right.
Sometimes, right? And I've seen some scrum masters who just really, you know, under the banner of self-direction, they're very quiet, and they sort of allow the team. Right. It's even worse when they come and talk to you and say, you know, they'll have private sideline conversations of how, you know, I'm really unhappy with my team. They're going in the wrong direction, and then they're quiet to the team.
Right.
So it's even worse then that they recognize the problems, but they're not bringing them up.
Yes.
Have we crashed and burned everywhere?
Most places.
Did we hit doneness? We hit doneness.
We did hit doneness a little bit, yeah.
Quality. I mean, I think crappy work. What about hacking, refactoring, stuff like that? Did we talk? I mean, teams. So it goes back to doing what's asked of you. Or doing what's required. Have you seen teams that fail?
I kind of roll that into the quality.
Did you? Is that what you were thinking?
Yeah. So to me, the quality encompasses everything. The quality of the app, but the quality of the code. You know, one of the things that I push is the Boy Scout rule. Always leave the campsite better than it was when you got there. And do the same thing with your code. So refactor relentlessly and be unafraid, and the best way to do that is to have the unit test to back you up.
So we didn't say that earlier, and I think we've added some flavor to the quality side of things. I like your campsite analogy.
Yeah.
And always leave it better, right?
Yes.
And so that's a failure to me. If you go in, again, it goes back to the buy route. Do you deliver just what, right? Did I deliver just to the essence of what was asked for? Am I doing a great job? Am I engaging the product owner? Am I getting early reviews? Am I refactoring properly?
Right.
It's Agile's not a buy route, just deliver what was asked of you process.
Right, and that's part of our doneness criteria of that. And that's part of the code review process for us is because if we aren't doing that, that's a failure of the entire team, of my entire development staff, because we are the stewards of our code. You know, so I really expect everyone to do it and to call a developer out during a code review that's not doing it. So it should never get to that. We should have enough gates set up to prevent that from happening. It's preached from the beginning. So
is there any failure in being too extreme, like too? And I don't have a. I'm wondering, can you be too agile and fail? Can you, you know? So is there a flip side? We've talked a lot about what you're not doing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you overdo anything? Have you ever seen any overdos? And I don't have one, so I'm wondering if you do.
About the closest I could come to is people that say, hey, we're agile, so we can change anytime, anywhere, anyhow. So that's not really the true essence of
agile. So that's an overdue.
Right, of people trying to be uber agile and trying to be agile like every 2 minutes. So if your release burn down gets ahead by half a point, what are we going to squeeze into that half a point? You know, so I've actually been somewhere where that's happened. Actually, my current job. Say, well, we're ahead. What else can we put
what
in?
What else can we do?
You know, like, we're ahead by 1 point. It's the first sprint, we're ahead.
Exactly.
Let's not panic.
Let's not panic. You know? Well, it's not positively panic, right?
Yeah.
You know what? I think you hit some... There's, like, the Uber side. So there's... Could there be Uber... I've seen Uber refactoring as well.
Yeah.
Like, you know... We need time. I've seen Uber refactoring pre-agile as well.
Yeah.
The application sucks. We need to rewrite it. Give us the time to rewrite it. So I've seen Uber. I think there's a whole pattern of Uber architecture in agile. Uber refactoring. Wanting to do too much. Not being incremental. Too much automation.
Right.
Or automation frameworks or something like that. So not slicing up. So that's probably a pattern that I've seen.
Right.
Is folks are trying to do, maybe it's amplify or do way too much.
Right. And it's tough because they're doing it for the right reasons.
It is the right reasons.
You just have to throttle them back a little
bit. It is the right reasons, right. And that's from a coaching perspective, you have to be careful. You don't want to neutralize that energy. So again, it's one of those things where a soft touch is required. Anything else where you think folks are over-agile? Is there a way, can you coach too much?
Oh, I'm sure.
Can you drive the team
to
beyond their capacity?
Yeah.
Have you know, asking more than is it fair to ask more than they're capable of? This goes back.
To me, that's that. I think you're verging on command and control, just doing it indirectly or implicitly, trying to do that same. So having a ulterior motive of trying to overdrive that team to hyper productivity and burning them out, or you know, there's a multiple of bad things that could happen.
Does a team fail if they're not hyper productive?
I've seen places where
you used a bad word there. I'm just pounced on that word. I can't help myself. I'm all over that word.
So I think that's one of those things that's the ideal, something for a team to strive for, but maybe isn't a reality everywhere.
So if I have a team that has had consistent velocity for, I'm just throwing a hypothetical out there. I have a team that has consistent velocity for the last year. So it's been relatively the same, a flat line of velocity for the last year. Are they succeeding or failing? So every sprint is relatively flat.
If I can get consistent delivery from a team, I'm happy.
Okay.
Now, there's consistently bad delivery, you know, so there's a team that you know is sandbagging and you want to get them to be honest, but if I can get a team back to that team that did 7 out of 10 but worked their tails off, if I can get them to consistently do that, every 2 weeks, I'm a happy guy.
See, I might be a slightly different. I might be pushing for improvement.
Yeah.
Right.
So but it's asymptotic, right? So you're never going to get to true hyper-productivity.
Did that hurt on the way out?
It did not
hurt. It did not? That came seamlessly out? Holy cow.
That's one of my favorite words.
I can tell.
That's one of my favorite words.
That hurt me. I'm like, oh, that was like, ouch.
Yeah, and you have to be honest with yourself and with your team of you're going to get to a level that it's going to be. It's like going from good to great. That's something I've been talking to my teams about. We're good teams. And we're very good teams. But what I want to do is I want to get us to great. But the effort and the difficulty that's required to go from good to great is a lot more than it is to go from bad to good.
And that's what I was actually trying to allude to that. So I think there's a sliding window to success and failure. And I think we as coach, you know, you're trying to move the bar slightly so that you're improving. Velocity is probably a poor way of measuring, improvement. I would think quality, right? Less bugs, less escapes, more refactoring, more willingness, even helping each other out, more developers helping with testing. You know, there's probably more powerful behavioral measures, but velocity is one of those. But are we changing over time culturally?
Right.
I remember at iContact when I first joined there, you know, the developers, you know, wouldn't work with testers at all.
Right.
And then a year later, so there's from my, and this isn't a velocity improvement. I mean, it has relationships to that. But now, you know, 18 months later, you know, developers are pulling testers in. I couldn't pry testers out of the teams.
Yeah, I mean, I've had members of my team say, you know what? You keep telling us that we're doing good, but you're never happy. You always want more. I'm like, well, yeah, you know, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to always get better.
But that's a sliding window, right?
Yeah.
And it's not. I think that's what good leaders and good coaches are trying to do. So it's sliding at the right pace and not getting weighed down. My velocity has been, our velocity has been relatively flat. So good news from your point of view and mine is predictable,
right?
At least we're consistent.
Right.
Now, over time, I would like to improve that. I would like to get closer to whatever hyper productivity
is. One of my yearly objectives is to improve productivity by 10%. Right, and at some point, I'm going to keep having the team improve by 10%, and we can't continue. It's not an infinite productivity gain.
Yep.
So
and there's a variety of factors there.
Yeah.
Anything else? Have we beat it?
We have. I think so.
I think we've covered. Let me pause. I think we've covered quite a bit. Maybe one additional failure is, and we've sort of tap danced around it, but reflection. And maybe that's a nice way to end this metacast. Is failing to reflect.
Right.
And what I mean by that is failing to demo and failing to retrospect.
Right.
And that could be having a retrospective but not improving it.
Right.
Like doing the what? Improve the good, the bad, and the ugly. Or getting into a by rote. So it could be having retrospective but they're not impactful.
Right.
It's having demos but you don't show working software.
Right.
Or you don't prepare properly for it, or you show peripheral stuff that no one cares about.
Right.
And then no one shows up over time. So you're doing demos to an empty room, and you're not paying attention to the empty room, right?
Right.
You're just, but we did our demo.
Right.
But no, was anyone really there?
Yeah.
So what do you think? So I think that could be...
That's a huge thing that I've even heard some of our teams say of, we want to stop our retrospectives because we're not getting anything out of it, you know. So the answer is not to stop it. The answer is to fix the problem.
Yep.
Right. So let's actually do something. Let's figure out why we're having these retrospectives and we're not doing anything about it. Of again, being honest with yourselves of saying, okay, so we've got a problem. We have an impediment to our growth. What are we going to do about it?
It's that reflection. It's looking at yourself in the mirror.
Yeah.
I think the failure is just not as a team. What is your commitment to improve?
Right.
And that, you know what it goes back to? There's no complacency in Agile, and I think that's one of the challenges. It's not laziness, but it's actually quite challenging to always raise the bar.
Right.
Right. And you do that in sports, I suspect, right? I doubt whether coaches are, you know, so you're always looking for a better time. You're always looking to lift more.
Right.
To get better. So it's a continual thing. Well, what does that say? From a team's perspective, it's like, crap. Where's my break? Where's my vacation? Yeah. So I'm empathetic to that, but I think it's
But true true greatness, right? So going back to sports, so the best are great because of the effort that they put in to become great.
Absolutely.
And that applies across the board.
And it's continuous effort. Yeah. It's not an end point, right? Yeah. It's I have to practice all the time.
Yeah. One of the things that I learned very early in college was one of my coaches said, you have to get better every day. Because you have to assume that everybody else you're going against is getting better every day. So if you stay the same, you're actually getting worse.
This worked out. Oh, what a rapper for the Metacast, man. I like that. Give me a high. All right. I like that. I hope the Metacasters. I think we wrapped this sucker up quite nicely. There's failure out there. There's success out there. It's a moving target. Point is, go down into little flames. I think it's failure's okay.
Yep.
Just fail small, I think, is a key. And just stay sharp and continuously improve.
How to get in touch with us?
Yeah.
We are at meta-cast, that's the actual symbol, .com, and on Twitter at meta-cast, all spelled out, because Twitter doesn't like non-alphanumeric characters.
Do we like feedback, Josh?
We love feedback. We have responded to feedback. We have had metacasts about requests. People have said, hey, can you talk about this? And we talk about it.
You're right. I forgot about that.
We have.
So we would like to continue that.
Yes, we would.
So send us your feedback in any form that we can digest. I can digest since I'm slightly older than Josh. I'll take smoke signals. I will take Morse code, telegrams. And Josh, on the other hand, will take texts and email.
Yes, please. That's the only way I can communicate, especially if you ask my wife.
We have a wide variety of mechanisms to reach out to us. We want to thank you for listening in. We hope you got something out of the cast. And just get us your feedback, get us your thoughts. We ought to apologize. We've been a little bit intermittent this year.
We had a small sprint failure.
We had a small, but we're going to fail forward. We are intending to fail forward.
Yes.
So look for more Metacast this year. And for Bob Galen.
And Josh Anderson.
Shake.
And bake.
We're out of here. You all have a good one.